Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. If you woke up today in a place like Hilla or Haiti or Darfur, you'd quite likely see your entire world as a conflict zone. The rest of us simply turn on the radio to hear news of nuclear weapons in North Korea and coups in Kyrgyzstan, and we know for certain that some lucky day, in the words of the folk singer Tom Lehrer, that someone will set the spark off and we will all be blown away. Well, hold that cheery thought. A new global survey tells us that the world is actually seeing less warfare than it has in over a decade. In fact, this study from the University of Maryland concludes that democracy is winning, autocracy is losing, and that number of armed conflicts continues to diminish. Now, if only someone could pass that along to Abu Musab al-Zarqawi and Donald Rumsfeld. This hour, we'll look at this global survey, and we'd like to hear from you in the conversation. Do you see the world becoming a safer, more peaceful place? And if the data shows that violent conflict is indeed going down, why do we read and hear so much about it? Is the increase in the amount of news and information skewing our sense of global stability? Or is it the changing nature of war that's altering our perception of conflict and safety? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me this hour is Greg Easterbrook, senior editor for The New Republic and visiting fellow with the Brookings Institution. He's written the cover story in this week's New Republic called The End of War? And joins us from a studio in Washington, D.C. Greg, it's nice to have you back on the program.
Hi, Dick.
Quick peek into the mechanics of this global survey, if you can start us off with that, Greg. How is peace and conflict measured year to year?
Well, two researchers affiliated with the University of Maryland, guys named Monty Marshall and Ted Robert Gurr, 5 years ago sat down to try to count up the basic toll of bloodshed and tears of the 20th century, the number of conflicts, the number of casualties. And what they expected to find was what people I would suppose guess was that the world was worse during World War II, and then things calmed down, and then recently things have gotten terrible again. But that's not what they found at all. Instead, they found that, of course, World War II was the low point of human history in a lot of ways, but that starting around the 1960s, international conflict began to rise, and it rose steadily through about 1990, which was when the Cold War ended, and has been declining ever since. The last 15 years, the number of conflicts in the world has gone down steadily. The intensity of fighting has gone down steadily. The number of casualties from conflict have gone down steadily. We here in the United States are obsessed, as well we should be, with the fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. But these things represent exceptions to the larger global phenomenon. The larger global phenomenon is that there's less fighting all the time.
You know, I'm thinking of what's in the papers these days, Iraq and Afghanistan and periodically stuff from the Soviet former republics. And I think back over the 1990s and the great bloody mess in the Balkans and Rwanda and something like that. And I'm thinking to myself, is this just proof that if you take the statistics and turn them some way, you can make a happy story out of it? Or when you get into it, are there really statistics to show that the world's a safer place?
Well, obviously, you don't want to sound like a Pollyanna when you talk about the decline of war. It's only a 15-year trend. It could turn out to be temporary. Right. There could be horrible surprises in store. And if you lived in Eastern Congo or some of the other places that you mentioned in your introduction, none of this matters to you. But according to the University of Maryland study, the number of wars in the world peaked in the year 1991 with 51 open conflicts in progress in the world at that time, mm-hmm. which may have been the peak point for most number of wars at any point in human history. It has fallen steadily since to 26 in the year 2000 to 20 today. The number of wars is declining, even though since in that period we've seen the al-Qaeda attack on the United States, our counterattack on Afghanistan, the invasion of Iraq, and other fighting. There are many places in the world where conflict is horrible and Hobbesian, but the total amount of conflict has been going down steadily since the Cold War ended, and we tend to fixate on the places where fighting is active, and of course those places are the most important places, skipping the fact that ever fewer people are exposed to combat. We can talk about the fatality statistics if you want, but it looks like the percentage of the world's population that is imperiled by war is today the lowest that it's ever been in human history.
So is it just our fixation on those few conflicts that leaves us with a mistaken impression that the world is every bit as violent and dangerous and warlike as it's been?
Well, for us here as Americans, because events since 9/11 have involved the United States, we're acutely aware of the fighting in Afghanistan and Iraq and Indonesia and other places, whereas the 20-year civil war in Angola, which was finally settled in the year 2000, which had absolutely no effect in the United States. Most Americans don't even know that it occurred, but there are far more casualties in that war than there have been in Iraq so far. That's just one example. I think for the globe generally, what's happened in the last 10, 15 years, at the same period that war is declining, reporting of war has gotten better and better between the internet and cable television and mini cams and satellite transmission, etc. The global media has gotten ever more efficient at showing us the images and taking us directly to any place where something in the world is going wrong. And I don't argue with that. The global media should do that. But in a world of 6 billion people, there will always be something that's blowing up or burning. And today, the media has gotten so much better at showing us the images of that thing, and whereas not showing us the images of water purification projects or rural electrification or things that matter to the majority of the world's population, we get the impression that fighting is increasing. Actually, what's increasing is coverage of fighting. Fighting itself is declining. Coverage of it is increasing.
And before we lose sight of something that you mentioned a couple of moments ago, Greg, that this link to the end of the Cold War. I mean, we could use your example of Angola as a place where the fighting was in many ways perpetuated by the conflicts of the Cold War and died in part as a result of that, no?
Yes, it's obvious to speculate that the main thing that's happened in the last 15 years that's caused war to diminish is the end of the Cold War. All through the Cold War period, the United States and the old Soviet Union funded proxy armies in various places and throughout Africa, Central America, South America, and in parts of Asia as well. They were proxy armies that were dependent on outside supplies of arms in order to fight. They were also fueled somewhat by ideological disputes that have declined since then. But the key thing is that they were getting boxes full of guns, bombs, and bullets. When the Cold War ended, both sides, us and the old Soviet Union, for the most part, stopped funding various factions in developing world nations. International shipments of arms have fallen dramatically in the last 15 years. Deprived of arms and the supplies with which to fight, rebellious factions in many places have by and large come grudgingly to the negotiating table. And Angola is a great example. They would have fought forever if there had been an unlimited supply of artillery shells. And now that their supplies are cut off, now there's a settlement.
And looking at the way that war and conflict is perceived in this country, if we use 9/11 as a point, people here watching what happens in Washington and abroad know that military spending in the United States has gone up. That would be another reason to believe that there's more war, I suppose.
Well, here in the United States is the exception in that rule. Global military spending is way down, and that's another one of the exciting positive points that you don't hear. The figure is that global military spending for all nations peaked at $1.3 trillion. That's an awful lot of money in the year 1985. That's stated in today's money, so the comparison is meaningful. Last year, 2004, global military spending was $1 trillion. So we've seen a decline in global military spending. If you do it on a per capita basis, because the population of the world was rising in the interim, the calculation's even more spectacular. In current dollars, the world spent in 1985 $260 per capita each year on military arms. Last year, the world spent $167 per capita. So adjusted for population, global military spending is down by more than a third in the last 20 years. And you have an obvious chicken or egg question. Is war declining because military spending is declining, or is military spending declining because war is declining? I don't know which one is the root cause, but I can say that statistically, both trends are going in the right direction.
There's another interesting observation that you and your scholarship add to this study from the University of Maryland, and that is your writing about anti-war sentiment, because this requires that we look back further than just 15 years, but that there's been a sort of rise in the currency or the acceptability of that. I hadn't thought about it as something new.
Sure. As recently, certainly as the Civil War in the United States or World War I in Europe, most people were very fatalistic about the occurrence of war. They viewed war as part of human nature, that government's ability to order men to march off to their deaths which really shouldn't be questioned. Questioning government's ability to make war was rare, and even in Western thought, until roughly 100 years ago. And I have many chilling quotes in my piece, but the one that really gets me to the bone was the great Oliver Wendell Holmes in 1895 told the graduating class of Harvard that one of the highest expressions of human honor is, quote, the faith which leads a soldier to throw away his life in obedience to a blindly accepted duty. People used to admire that sort of thing and think that war was a mechanism for progress. Just in the last century in the Western world, we've seen a countervailing view of anti-war sentiment arise. Obviously, even some people who are anti-war would say that World War II and some other wars are just. But a view has arisen in Western culture that war is usually avoidable and often absurd, and that it's the least rational way for nations to settle their disputes, and that the old grand illusion of warfare without general destruction, which existed roughly till World War I, is now shattered. Nobody believes that great nations can fight without the innocent suffering terribly. And this is, I think, another reason why war is in decline. People are just wising up to the foolishness of it.
Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. Do you accept the premise of the study? Do you think that war is in decline? Do you see it as a trend which stretches back more than 15 years? Is the world wising up to the effects of war, or is that just wishful thinking? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Greg Easterbrook is our guest this hour. He is senior editor for The New Republic and visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution. And we're talking about the cover story that he's written in this week's New Republic called The End of War. Your thoughts on whether or not the statistics in fact bear out, or whether or not the statistics show us the world that we live in, or if you have a different view on this. 1-800-423-TALK. To Newton, Massachusetts for a call from Marilyn. Hi, Marilyn.
Good morning.
What do you think?
Well, I have a question and a comment. The question is, the study looks at, and I'm asking about your premise, I think it's legitimate to look at whether or not international and national and even local conflicts have declined. But what I read, and I'm a close follower of the news, it seems to me that the amount of sheer violence in our country and all over the world has increased enormously, and I don't just get this from newspaper headlines. Mm-hmm. I do a lot of reading. And so, first of all, I'm wondering, if you were to look at the number of people who are suffering as a result of not only conflict around the world, but policies of governments around the world, and who consequently are dying from violence, it seems to me, from what I read, that it has increased enormously. And my quick comment is, in terms of feeling safer, I've spent a good part of my life taking subways in Boston, and only in the past few years have I felt a kind of tremor of fear when I get onto trains, into subways, when I go into South Station, and I wonder, is today the day the terrorists are going to strike? Because there is a so-called war on terror, and that is a very different kind of thing from international conflict.
So when you talk about the violence that you're keeping track of, it's the bomb that kills 20 or 30 people at a temple in Afghanistan earlier today. It's
also
the bomb in Pakistan yesterday.
Yes, and it's also people in rainforests being cut down by machetes because of policies of corporations that have come in. And I mean, this is not a diatribe against corporations at all. What I'm saying is that also the kind of economic development that's taking place all over the world is bringing in violent forces that are affecting people in ways that sometimes don't even get reported.
Greg,
people
test this against what we know from the peace and conflict study and your own work here.
Well, things could be a lot better in a lot of places. Marilyn's certainly right about that. To argue that violence is declining is certainly very different from arguing that things are fine or that people are safe or anything like that. All I'm arguing is that the statistics show that violence is declining. When it comes to war and deaths related to war, that is from malnutrition or disease caused by war, similar things, the World Health Organization tracks that statistic. That statistic has been in steady decline now for about 15 years, the same period that that war has been in decline. The most recent year figure shows that about 300,000 people globally were killed by war or causes related to war, such as malnutrition, for the most recent year in which statistics are available. Now, 300,000 people is a terrible number. It's a horrible toll.
What year is that, Greg, just to be clear?
That's 2000 is okay. The latest. The WHO has a study on this every 5 years. That 300,000 people is a terrible number to behold, but it's approximately 0.001% of the human population. In the same year, 1.2 million people globally were killed in auto accidents. So, and this is a figure for all nations, including developing nations. So your odds today of being killed by a car are about four times greater than your odds of dying by war or civil war or ethnic fighting and so on. We fear and obsess, and rightly so, over people blowing themselves up in Iraq and Afghanistan as today, or in the Middle East or anyone else. It's scary. It's destructive. It's awful. But, you know, the hard reality of the numbers is of the 20 estimated people who died in Afghanistan today in that bombing, probably 1,000 people died worldwide in auto accidents. And since they didn't occur in any specific obvious central place, you didn't hear about them and you never will. You did hear about the bomb that went off.
So keep it in context, though, of the number of people who have died over time in these kinds of war or causes related to war. If it was 300,000 in the year 2000, according to the WHO statistics. If we go back 10 years before that or 15 years before that, is that substantially higher?
The average for the 20th century was about 2 million people per year killed by war.
The average for the 20th century, 2 million per year.
Yes, but that's
wow.
That's thrown way off by World War II
and around World War II,
the Holocaust, the Stalin death camps, et cetera. Most of those deaths happened in the middle of the century.
1-800-423-8255. Hilton Head, South Carolina. Tom's joining us from there. Hi, Tom.
Good morning.
What are your thoughts?
I'm concerned with the underlying premise of the study. It seems to me that it's almost saying that a decline in warfare automatically equates to an increase in peace. And I wonder if this isn't a slippery slope by which, if the world were being ruled under absolute tyranny, but there was no fighting, that we would be living in a state of world peace. I'll take your comments on
that. But I think, just stick with me for half a sec, Tom. I think that according to the peace and conflict study, North Korea gets a red flag, a poor rating, although the people there are not engaged in actual fighting. Am I right about that, Greg?
Yes, that's correct. It red flags several countries, and North Korea is the worst one.
So, Tom, does that answer your concern there or not?
Well, North Korea, if I'm not mistaken, has a very large military, and I know that there's still that zone between North and South Korea where the constant threat of the outbreak of war exists.
Right.
I'm just wondering, do the authors of the study necessarily see a relationship between the decline of warfare and the increase in peace? And if so, I just wonder what peace is, and if it isn't the kind of peace one might find in a jail cell. I think
it's a great question. Greg, there are other measures that Marshall and Gurr use in their study that I think will help answer Tom's question. Can you help us with
that? Well, sure. The absence of war is certainly peace, but peace doesn't necessarily mean freedom or happiness or liberty or positive condition. It just means the absence of war. So you look at other measures of this, and the key one is the rise of democracy in the world. The central statistic here is that in 1975, one-third of the world's nations held true multi-party elections. Today, two-thirds do, and the proportion of democratic countries continues to rise. Now, because you live in a democracy also doesn't mean that you're happy, but we'd certainly overall much rather people live in democracies than under totalitarian states. Democracy is expanding just about everywhere. There have been very few examples in our generation of countries going in the other direction, away from democracy toward repressive rule. And we must assume that the increase in democracy has something to do with the decline in fighting. Historically, democracies fight far less than totalitarian states do. Morton Halperin has a new book out called The Democracy Advantage that talks about the relationship between increase in democracy and decline of war. Historically, democracies have fewer civil wars or ethnic wars than totalitarian states do as well. So democracy is rising, war is declining. It's what you would expect. It doesn't guarantee that people would be happier, that conditions couldn't be better. It just tells you that the trend lines are going in the right direction.
And prosperity would have to have some factor in here as well, I would imagine, Greg.
Oh, sure. Prosperity and democracy are linked in both directions, and that is that each one amplifies the other. Democracy makes possible the conditions in which people become prosperous, and prosperity, giving people a stake in the economic system, makes them want to stop fighting and protect the world and safeguard their children and their neighborhoods and so on. Now, these things can lead to many paradoxes, and that gives me an excuse to mention my own book, The Progress Paradox, which is out right now, which is about how rising affluence doesn't necessarily make people any happier, which is what we observe in Western society. But still, you've got to be in favor of affluence, democracy, and peace, even if they don't necessarily lead to happiness.
I wanted to ask you about that because you were actually with us on the program in, I think, December 03, talking about the progress paradox and making the point then that the better off people get, the easier life is. The more people tend to fret around about the world around us. And if that's perhaps a part of the point that was being made earlier in the program about just people feeling uncomfortable about their life, their place on the planet.
Oh, they do. It's hard to measure, but I would guess if you could measure it, you would find that anxiety is steadily rising in the United States. Anxiety about the global economy, jobs, terrorism, environment, etc. People are more, I bet you $1 million that Americans as a group are more anxious today than they've ever been before. Even though we live better today than ever before, freedom has never been higher, disease rates have never been lower, longevity has never been greater, living standards have never been higher, education levels have never been higher. We're better off by just about everything we can measure, but we're certainly more anxious. And one reason, and this may relate to our perception of war and conflict, is that as the nation becomes more prosperous, and the only thing wrong with prosperity is that everybody doesn't have it, but as the nation becomes more prosperous, we all have more time to sit around and watch CNN and see pictures of things blowing up and worry about it.
So in answer to the point that Marilyn raised earlier about just feeling uncomfortable in crowded underground subway stations and things like that, that relates directly to what you're talking about. What do you say to Marilyn about something like that, that she's just one of a number of people who share the same feeling?
Well, Marilyn, your caller Marilyn lives in Boston and she rides the T. If you just look at crime statistics for both Boston and the T, they've all been positive for 20 years. The murder rate in Boston is less than half today what it was 20 years ago. I'm sure the homicide rate in the T system is at or near an all-time low. But that doesn't necessarily affect how your anxieties are managed. And since we're ever more conscious of terrorism, we've seen that terrorism is capable of being international and striking anyone anywhere. Your odds of any one of your listeners to your show ever in their lives being affected by terrorism are astonishingly tiny. They're like the odds of being hit by lightning. But, you know, we're afraid of lightning, too. So it's totally natural.
Let's go to Sudbury, Massachusetts for a call from Dimitri. Hi, Dimitri. What do you think?
I have a point to make that has to do with historical tradecraft. These are generally historical trends, and to eke out a contemporaneous social meaning out of them is very difficult. When you study
difficult
history,
and dangerous, or just
difficult and maybe improper. When you study history, it's proper to do that in the historical context of the time. So a medieval man who's used to his society transported to today's world would be thrilled to find out that we only have one genocide and one ethnic cleansing per decade. But does that mean that we, as modern people, should consider that to be a really great improvement over the way things should be? That's one point that I'd like to make.
But can we stick with that for just half a second, Dimitri?
Sure.
If there were 30 conflicts in the world last year and there are 28 or 30 or 25 this year, what's wrong with using that measure and saying, well, that's got to be an improvement?
Well, it is, but if you stretch that out over even 50 years, then people's expectations change as well. For example, the generation of World War II was thrilled when the war was over. They were just happy to have minor wars going on and not be involved in it themselves. But our expectations are very different because the society has moved on. And it is really improper to take historical trends like that and try to say that today we have an ironclad, you know, societal takeaway that we should be, in fact, happy with the current state of affairs because we, on the average, are dying less than in before. Of course we are. A whole bunch of things have changed for the better. But have they changed for the better to a point where people can really feel good about them? And I think that's a very relative measure and a very relative constant to try to stretch over even a few decades.
What do you think, Greg?
Well, I in my book, Progress Paradox, which we talked about before, Dick, I end that by saying that even if the world achieved a physical utopia, people would still grumble about the predictable diet of milk and honey. That no matter how good things are, people will still be discontent. I think it's wired into human nature to feel that way. To reiterate what we've said twice already on the show, to say that things are getting better is not the same as saying that we live in the best of all possible worlds or even that things are necessarily good. My point is only that warfare is declining and that this is an optimistic trend. There's a million things about the world that should be better than they are, especially in the developing world. But even if you're only familiar with the United States and Western Europe, we've got all kinds of inequities and problems with health care and poverty and other big issues. And boy, if you go to Africa, it's like another planet. I don't want anybody to misunderstand me. I'm only saying that warfare is declining. I'm not saying that it shouldn't be much better than it is already.
But part of what I hear Dimitri saying, and Dimitri, if you're still with me, you can jump back in and tell me if I get this wrong, but part of what you're saying is that there's a risk in choosing just a chunk of history and saying, based on the trends over that time, we see something?
That's right. And you know, our expectations in the 21st century are very different than the expectations of the people in the middle of the 20th century. And it is fine to say that the statistics, and I don't quibble with that, the statistics do show an improvement. There's no question about it. But so have our expectations. Our expectations have moved on. So that point, that sort of the takeaway that the war is declining, it is a fact, but it's not a fact that you can take out of the societal context in which it is made.
And I guess, Greg, to take it another step forward, it doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, a year or two or 5 years from now we won't be right back into the thick of some internation conflict.
Sure, that's the key point. This is only a 15-year trend. 15 years is pretty short by the standards of history. There could be some ugly surprise that disproves all this. A nuclear war could start tomorrow, and then you would say, well, gee, based on the 15-and-a-half-year trend, the world got much worse.
Mm-hmm. So Dimitri, just if you take away all the statistics and just look at the world that we're in, are you saying that you're pretty suspicious about any shift towards peace, any disappearance of war?
I'm suspicious of any kind of false complacency. And I like Mr. Estabrook's writing. I'm a subscriber to the New Republic. I'm slightly suspicious that just at the time when public support for the Iraq war has declined, out comes a neat little study that says, hey, we're doing so much better than before. We should all take pride in that. And I'm a little uncomfortable with that right at this point in our history.
Quick word from you, Greg. We've got a.
I don't think the study has anything to do with that, since they started working on this series of studies 4 years before the Iraq War began.
And there is the nesting facts of, you know, the increase in democracy being something that the White House talks a lot about, and the increase in democracy being something that is definitely a part of this study as well. Maybe that's what raises some of the suspicion in Dimitri's eyebrows.
Well, democracy is increasing. How much credit Bush administration policies should receive, I really don't have any idea. But what sticks in my mind is the important point that there are more people living in freedom every year.
Connection listeners, how's the world as you see it? In fact, can you make the case, can you stand by the case that war is in decline? Should we look at that as something of a larger shift, a larger trend, not just in this country or in this hemisphere, but are we seeing a diminished appetite for this kind of conflict all around the world? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection. My guest this hour, Greg Easterbrook, senior editor for The New Republic, author of a book called The Progress Paradox, How Life Gets Better While People Feel Worse. And that's pretty well in sync with what we're talking about here. Taking a look at a peace and conflict study, 2005, from the University of Maryland. It is the third in a series of studies by the academics there, tracing a pretty consistent decline in war, and asking you if you, in fact, see that same decline. Do the definitions work in the world as you see it? 1-800-423-TALK to Boston for a call from George. Hi, George. What do you think?
Yes, I have a question with respect to the study. I noticed that it seems to be set up around formal conflicts between named and identified groups, and I'm looking at the rise of terrorism and what you might call diffuse conflict from unorganized groups. Al-Qaeda is semi-organized, but it's not a nation state. Does the study involve those kinds of conflicts and the sort of
No, it's a good question. I mean, if we've got 50 angry guys with AK-47s somewhere on the planet, are they factoring into this, Greg?
The answer to that is yes. The study has extensive sections on ethnic conflict, small-scale violence, regional war, undeclared or non-government wars, and also, of course, on terrorism.
Because that's in many ways a part of the trend or the shift or the change that we're watching, isn't it?
Well, terrorism you can't obviously claim is declining. The main focus of this contention is that warfare and armed conflict, open fighting of any kind, is declining worldwide. Terrorism, the world has had about 3,000 global deaths from terrorism every year for the last 15 years or so, the same period in which deaths from combat and declared hostilities have declined. Deaths from terrorism have remained roughly constant.
1-800-423-8255 is the number to join us. There's another part in this, Greg, that I wanted to ask you about, and that is the role of the UN, because you put your finger on peacekeeping as a key part of the shift that we're changing. Are we looking at a change in peacekeeping as well?
Oh, yes, definitely. The world spends ever more on peacekeeping every year, and peacekeeping is turning out to be a fantastically good investment. If you look at the big causes of decline of war in the last 15 years, the end of the Cold War must be the main cause. The rise of democracy is probably the second cause. We can argue if you want in a minute, I would say that globalized economics are the third cause. But the fourth cause is the increasing effectiveness of the United Nations. The UN spends about $3 billion on peacekeeping every year. There are thousands of United Nations and also NATO and now African Union soldiers walking the streets in troubled parts of the world, keeping warring factions away from each other. It hasn't been perfect. There have been problems, obviously, as everybody knows, in Bosnia and Congo especially. But by and large, peacekeeping seems to work. And it's, I would say, dollar for dollar for the United States or any nation to invest a dollar in peacekeeping is much better at preventing fighting than to invest a dollar in construction of weapons.
It's funny, isn't it? I mean, because there again, it's the counterintuitive part of the story. When we pick up a newspaper and read about peacekeeping, it is, you know, soldiers with the African Union who are failing to keep the peace in Darfur, or who are, you know, raping small girls in Congo, that sort of thing. We're not reading about places where the peacekeeping works.
Right. You're not reading about the majority of places where there are peacekeeping operations, because the operations are working in most places. You know, peacekeeping failed at Srebrenica terribly, so it's parts of Darfur it hasn't worked. But in most of Africa and Central Asia and the Middle East, peacekeeping's been a great investment, and it's been successful, and you don't read or hear about it because the result of the peacekeeping is that nobody's fighting.
1-800-423-8255. Next to Raleigh, North Carolina, Earl's on the line. Earl, thanks for calling.
Yes, hello. Good to be with you. I'm enjoying your show. I'm a little bit confused about a couple of things. And I'm watching the news every night and reading the paper and listening to NPR, and I just don't see where there's a decline in war. And, you know, maybe I'm looking somewhere else, but and people are not disgruntled by nature. Something causes them to be that way. And let's just go with your guest premise. If there is a decline, if there's people this much disgruntled, and there is a decline in war, and something is wrong, then I think we should probably be worried about an undercurrent of something. I would think that would cause stress. It causes me some. But I just don't see where there's a decline in war. And please help me to understand that, because I don't see
just it. Stay on the line, Earl. I'm going to get Greg to talk to you here.
Okay. Hi, Earl. Well, just think about our own backyard. Hi. Think about Central and Latin America through the 70s and 80s. There was open and very violent conflict in Nicaragua, Guatemala, Chile, Argentina, Bolivia. Most of Central and South America had open, active fighting. Today, there's still active fighting in Colombia. I certainly wouldn't go to Colombia unless I absolutely had to. But all those other nations are relatively tranquil, and all those other nations...
Yes, I'm sorry. Please go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, you go ahead.
No, I you know, you say that they're kind of tranquil, but I don't see that. I see widespread poverty in these countries, and we also know that from every study that where there is widespread poverty, there is the potential, and also there is violence, but it's not being reported on as much. And because it's not conflicts, I guess, between it's not a state-sponsored conflict necessarily. It may be conflicts between groups. It may be conflicts between tribes or whatever. But there is definitely conflict, and maybe it's not being reported on as widespread. And maybe it's something we don't know that we should be paying attention to.
Go ahead, Greg.
Yeah, certainly there's the continuing. In much of South and Central America and in a lot of the South Asia and in most of Africa, poverty remains endemic. Illiteracy is still a problem. Joblessness are still a problem. These are all fomenters of social unrest, and they are all unhappy trends. But they're not fighting, which is what we're talking about in this show. And I can also tell you from what happiness data and psychological research shows, those are my favorite things to read. In the parts of Latin America where standards of living has risen in the last 20 years, in a lot of Latin and Central America, you know, urban incomes are way up, happiness has actually gone down. People report themselves as being less satisfied with their lives than they did 20 years ago, even though incomes are rising in most of the urban parts of Latin and Central America.
I wonder if we can take a specific of Earl's question one step further, though, Greg, when he says that he's making his decision on what's going on in the world based on what he reads and what he sees and what he hears on the radio. Would it be fair to say that, you know, if we flipped back 10 or 15, 20 years, there would have been many more conflicts underway at the time, and they weren't being reported back then?
Yes, I think if you got in a time machine and watched the news in the 1960s, you wouldn't even have known that the Algerian War for Independence, to cite an example, was occurring, even though that was one of the most brutal wars of the 20th century. You might not have even known where Algeria was or been able to find it on an outline map. Today, of course, you would have round-the-clock coverage of people being killed in Algeria, and you should. People should. You know, when there's violence, people should know it. It just can give the wrong impression of the overall trend that affects most people. If you watch any local newscast at night, whether it's in North Carolina or Earl is or in Boston where many of your listeners are, you would get the impression that all that happens in your city is auto accidents and gunshots. Because that's all the local channels are reporting on. They're not telling you about anything else. They're telling you about the auto accidents and gunshots. Well, most of us have enough. We see our own cities. We know our own lives around us. We know enough to be able to sense from our own common sense that what the 11 o'clock news is showing us is not the average experience of the person in our cities. But we don't know what's happening in Africa or South America, so we tend more to generalize from the media.
So the skew is kind of the same. And when we think back to the years when crime was all over the news sentencing was made tougher. We now look back at that time and we're told, in fact, that at that very moment crime was going down. It just wasn't the way it was being covered. Would you make the same parallel about war today?
I guess. I think of the crime wave there was a period from the 1970s through the late 80s when crime did dramatically increase in the United States. People tended, you know, probably the most coverage of it didn't occur until the 1990s after
right.
The crime wave broke. And we may see the same thing with war today, that if there's another 5 or 10 years of declining conflict in the world, which we can all hope is what will happen, then people will begin to catch on and say, you know, maybe this is significant. This has been going on for a while now. Maybe we should report it. But I think with the media, there's also the structural problem is that pictures of conflict are visually dramatic. They're compelling. They draw viewers. Something burning and surrounded by screaming people causes you to watch television, whereas a scene of a water purification project in Somalia is not going to make you watch the evening news, even though the latter thing may have more long-term significance.
Let's go to Bedford, New Hampshire for a call from Beth. Hi, Beth.
Hello. I have a question, whether we in the United States historically right now are more involved in conflicts or less involved in conflicts than we have been in the past?
Well, it would depend on where you looked. Obviously, during World War II, it was the peak of human conflict for most nations. Right now, American involvement in the world is very high in by any measure, by number of soldiers stationed overseas, by active fighting in two places, by the deployment of our divisions, et cetera. So we're pretty high on anybody's scale of involvement in global conflict.
Thinking, Beth, that maybe this is why people in this country don't grab onto the idea that war is in decline.
Exactly. I'm just thinking that that's probably why we feel less secure. Also, I personally believe that our current administration brings us to that fear. When people start to feel calm, something seems to happen, and we start to regain that fear again. So that's just the way that I see it.
Well, there is. Sorry, Greg. Go ahead.
Well, we never know. You have to ask yourself the question, compared to what? Suppose United States forces were not spread all across the globe. There wouldn't be a war in Iraq, of course, and maybe there wouldn't be a war in Afghanistan. But would there be a war in Korea? Would Japan have reemerged as a military power? Many aspects of tranquility in the world today are probably caused by the fact that American forces are spread all over the world. But we never know for sure, because you never know what would have happened if you hadn't done something.
Greg, you quote in your piece the political scientist John Mueller talking about the possibility that war is in fact becoming seen by people as a bad idea in the way that other, what are the other ones that he uses? Slavery is seen as a bad idea. Do you think there's truth in that? Do you think he's got something?
I hope so. John Mueller should be a significant figure in American letters. He's a poli-sci professor at Ohio State. He's written two really brilliant books, one called Retreat from Doomsday, written in the late 1980s, which, among other things, predicted that the Soviet Union was about to collapse. He was certainly right about that. And his second one out recently called The Remnants of War, which has to do with small state fighting and tribal conflicts, and the things one of the earlier callers mentioned. His central contention is that war is not a fundamental element of human nature, that it's a bad idea, like slavery or dueling or any other silly, dumb idea that human beings came up with, and that by gradually enlightening ourselves, we can wean ourselves from warfare as a way to resolve disputes. Now, obviously, people have predicted in the past, prominently H.G. Wells, that warfare would fade away, and it hasn't yet. And yet we see some signs in the world of the sort of enlightenment that would lead to long-term decline in war. A great one came after World War II, when the United States, instead of imposing punitive terms on Germany and Japan, helped bring them back into the family of nations. The result was that no long-term hostilities were fostered that led to another war. At the end of the Cold War, rather than imposing punitive terms on the big losers, Russia and China, we've helped them, if fitfully, re-enter the normalized family of nations. Things like that break cycles of violence may lead to long-term improvements in human affairs.
The idea that punishing the losers is no longer the way to end war.
Yeah, cyclically, many wars have been caused by generations that were embittered by the victors' terms of previous wars. And from World War II, there were no—obviously, World War I helped beget World War II, and for that reason. But World War II was not followed by any of that punitive treatment of the defeated, and the Cold War has not been followed by that. And that's one of the signs you can point to nations sort of wising up to the desirability of not structuring the world in ways that cause war.
Let's take a call from Lansing, Michigan. Fred's joining us on the line from there. Fred, thanks for calling.
Thank you. How do we maybe need to reinvent our news media somehow to deal with counterintuitive data, such as the fact that violence is declining when we look around us and see the World Trade Center bombings and taking our shoes off at airports and stuff like that?
Do you mean how do we get more good news on the evening news, Fred? Is it that simple, or are you talking about something a little more philosophical than that?
I think we need to figure out look at the way we process news now, and what is the result of the product of that process, and what is it the message that it's sending to society, and how do we interpret that, and how does the media help us deal with that?
Yeah, what do you think, Craig?
I've thought about this, and I'm not sure what the answer is. Obviously, you would never want to say to the media, no, don't show us images of things blowing up in Iraq. That's the fact that people are committing suicide in Iraq is very important to international understanding. And negative news is often the news we most urgently need to hear. What I wish the media would do is, for every negative story, just run a positive story. Not to be Pollyanna-ish, but for every story about something being destroyed, run a story about something being built. And for every story about a policy that fails, run a story about a reform that works. I guarantee you can find more examples of success than failure in the world by a pretty hefty margin. And yet our media coverage in the United States is composed almost entirely of stories of failure. And that is my main complaint about the media, although, of course, under the First Amendment, any changes that would be made have to be made internally, so that you can't tell the media to do anything.
What would capitalism tell us about that?
Say again, Fred?
What would capitalism tell us about that? Is that what people want to buy? Is that what
Well, happening? I mean, make it personal for me, Fred. If you got up and the NPR News had a story about the latest suicide bombing in Iraq and it was followed by, you know, something that was working in Afghanistan, would you stay with the newscast? Would you sort of leapfrog to the bad news? Or would you go with that in the way that Greg's described it?
What you've said is exactly why I listen to public radio, is because not only do I hear about things that aren't working, but I hear a lot about things that are working. And I think public radio is great, but it takes 2 hours to get all that.
I thank you for your call, Fred. I don't know, Greg.
I'm sure there's a lot to his point. An NPR, if you say, and now we're going to do a segment about a forest preservation initiative in Northern California that worked, a lot of people will listen to that. If you said those same words on CNN, they'd immediately click to Fox to see if there was a picture of something exploding.
Greg, I thank you so much for being with us on this. It's a fascinating piece.
Sure thing, Dick.
Greg Easterbrook, senior editor for The New Republic and visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution. Now, our website is www.theconnection.org. You can find a link to Greg's New Republic cover story, The End of War? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.